This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. Geico has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
Compass Media Networks. This is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Calling college towns for help. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
New research finds that America's long economic stagnation might get a boost by relying more on areas where there are big universities.
On the medical front, why diabetics better watch their wallet. Insurance companies are adjusting to the soaring price of insulin.
The technology changes in the coming year that will impact things like transportation, government, and cyber warfare.
And at the gym, the fitness classes that are so tough, you have to qualify to get in.
At the Fitting Room in New York City, they do high-intensity interval training, and what they've added is what they call their Fixtreme class, which is just simply more intense, more difficult combinations, and they time the members, so there's an ongoing competitive angle to it.
Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman on what's trending at some boutique gyms. She's here in about 20 minutes. A nationwide study by the Brookings Institution for the Wall Street Journal has found 16 geographic areas where overall job growth was strong, even though manufacturing employment fell more sharply in those places from 2000 to 2014 than in the U.S. as a whole. Among the 16 surprisingly resilient areas, half are home to a major university, including Athens, Georgia, Charlotte, North Carolina, Charlottesville, Virginia, Corvallis, Oregon, and Auburn, Alabama. A look at what's working from the Wall Street Journal's Bob Davis. Bob, what'd you guys look at?
Well, we were trying to figure out why it is that some places that are hit by economic shocks, something like, you know, a big import surge from China, why is it that some places manage to sort of slough it off and go on while it cripples, you know, most of the areas that get hit? And you look at a lot of the indicators of what economists call resilience, and what you see very often is the presence of a college town, presence of a college or university makes a really big difference.
Interesting. All right, so you start off by looking at Opelika, Alabama. Explain that.
Well, Opelika was one of these areas that was hard hit by Chinese imports and also by changes in technology, textile industry. They had a exercise equipment maker, tire maker, all went out of business or moved away. And again, in many places in the country, similar circumstances, the community is essentially devastated and doesn't really bounce back. But Opelika, within 10 years, was able to bounce back, has been able to attract new investment. And one of the big reasons is that Opelika, which no one's ever heard of outside of Albany, or outside of Alabama, rather, is right next to Auburn. And Auburn, in addition to being a football powerhouse, is a big land-grant school and has a very good engineering and business emphasis.
All right. So is it one thing to be connected to a college town and another to actually have some sort of partnerships in place with, say, businesses?
Well, I mean, just having a college will be useful in that it's a big employer, but that's just like any big employer. What makes colleges different is they produce knowledge and they produce skilled workers, and that is attractive to most any business. So the question is, how do you tap into that advantage? Some places like Auburn and Opelika have done it very well. They work in tandem with the college, works in tandem with the economic development people, and it's works, as I say, to help bring in new businesses or keep businesses there. Other areas, for instance, in upstate New York, in the Binghamton, New York area, which was the home of IBM, Endicott, New York was the home of IBM, just was devastated by the loss of electronic manufacturing. Again, part of it is foreign competition. A lot of it was technology. And they still are suffering. And only now are they really trying to make use of the presence of Binghamton University. Cornell's not that far away from there. They have the potential. They just haven't harnessed it.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal senior editor Bob Davis. His piece is called "There's an Antidote to America's Long Economic Malaise, College Towns." So not every area, obviously, can have a college town. Is there something they can do to sort of pretend that they do?
Well, there are a lot of things. First of all, there's a lot more colleges than people think there are. There's almost 5,000 of them. So they are scattered around the country. The U.S. is much more decentralized than almost any other country in terms of higher education. So one thing is there are a lot of them. But for places where there aren't, big state universities will open satellite offices, which might be just a building, essentially. You would be able to use long-distance learning, internet-style learning, but you'd have instructors as well. I mean, those things help. And just the presence of even something like that, a satellite university, tends to increase the percentage of kids who go on to college and finish college, and that's a big plus.
What else jumped out at you here as you were pulling this together?
Well, I mean, colleges, when I thought of college towns, I mean, I think everybody's seen a college town, right? I mean, you think of fancy ice cream places and kids doing too much on Saturday night and so on, and maybe professors who spin off high tech ideas, but it would be really, the benefits would really go toward people, highly skilled people, wealthier people, and so on. But one of the things that was really interesting is that for people without a college education, for high school educated, people without a high school degree, they wind up benefiting on a percentage basis even more, because basically what happens is demand for services goes up, and the demand for workers to work in those kind of services, whether they're restaurants or the service parts of factories that open up there.
Thanks, Bob. The Wall Street Journal's Bob Davis. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Welcome aboard. First full weekend in January. If you've got a diabetic in the family, you're familiar with this scenario. A new study says since 2002, the cost of insulin has increased by almost 200%. That said, many parents of diabetic children and adults suffering with type 1 or type 2 diabetes are bracing for changes in insurance coverage of their insulin this year as prices continue to soar. Jane O'Donnell at USA Today says higher insurance deductibles and changes in the prescription brands covered are raising concerns among those who suffer from the disease. Jane, set the scene.
Well, prices of insulin are skyrocketing. So insurance companies and the pharmacy benefit companies that act like insurance companies or act with insurance companies to negotiate the drugs your insurance covers, they are pretty much fighting back. And a lot of people are going to find, if they haven't already, that there will be changes in what their insurance covers, what brands of insulin.
Wow. All right. So why are prices soaring?
Because they can.
Yeah.
I'm being slightly sarcastic, but I guess it's a matter of something that one could ask the drug companies. But when I've asked the drug companies about price hikes generally, they will say that they need to be able to raise prices to cover the costs of innovation and research and development. Critics of the drug companies say that, particularly with things like insulin or epinephrine with the EpiPen, these are not new, incredibly innovative drugs. They've been around for an awfully long time, both of them. And that some of these are very unreasonable. And often regular people, we don't notice these things until our insurance starts making us pay more out of pocket or forces us to change. I found that with EpiPens. Until parents started really speaking out and saying, holy cow, now that my deductible is so high, I am paying a lot out of pocket. It was that kind of, grassroots effort that really led to some of the changes and all the mini scandal or major scandal on Capitol Hill and elsewhere.
Right. All right. So what are some of the changes that are being made here that consumers might face?
So, you know, in the instance, if CVS Caremark is a person's pharmacy benefit manager, PBM as it's called, they would no longer be able to use Lantus, and they would get, there's a biosimilar version. Certain drugs are called biologics rather than just brand name drugs, and that's because they're based on more natural sources. So the biosimilar is like the generic, so this Basaglar, I think that's how you pronounce it, is what people would get.
Boy, so what's a consumer to do? I mean, folks with diabetes, I mean, they need the insulin.
Yeah, I have a new appreciation for what people go through, including people I know, and never really appreciated what they went through when they found out their children had type 1 diabetes. You know, pretty much to work closely with their doctor, to visit the doctor regularly. You know, try out. You know, you're not going to get an exception to the formulary unless you try it. I don't believe, unless there was some very compelling reason why this was not going to be right for you. And you would try it out and monitor any symptoms. It's too late to change insurance right now, but file an exception. You know, often I've found from decades of covering issues like this, and as a consumer reporter, and more recently a healthcare policy reporter, it's often the voice that the squeaky wheel or the loudest voice that often gets results. So you really might have to fight with the PBM or your insurance company.
Of course, thanks, Jane O'Donnell. Health policy reporter at USA Today. 21 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. If you're a workout junkie who's looking to go next level, your time has arrived. It's extreme. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Maybe your New Year's resolution is to get in shape. If you're in shape, maybe it's to get in super-duper shape. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal is here with a look at some new advanced training classes that are sweeping through the country. Rachel, what's this all about?
Well, this is really an outgrowth of the boutique fitness studio boom, which really has swept the country, but has been really concentrated in larger cities. And boutiques are, you know, smaller fitness centers that focus on maybe a few types of workouts, and they develop often these really devoted followings. But that has created a problem, which is that some people who've been going there for a year or two have kind of plateaued. So hence these new classes.
All right. What are we talking about in terms of exercises? What are they doing?
Well, it really depends. At the Fitting Room in New York City, which actually has two locations, they do high-intensity interval training. And what they've added is what they call their Fixtreme class, which is just simply more intense, more difficult combinations, and they time the members. So, they'll say, do this, that, and that, and we're going to time you, keep track of how much weight you use, and track this over time. So there's an ongoing competitive angle to it. And people, despite the degree of difficulty, they really like it.
Is there a type of person who is taking these classes?
Well, they tend to be younger, as you might imagine. They tend to be very fit, as you also might imagine. And I also think that they're looking for something different. You know, at the It's Working Out studio in Cincinnati, they use these TRX straps that you can use your body weight for kind of resistance exercises. And every few months, the owner of that studio holds a class she calls Super Slow Sets. And this means that instead of, you know, repetitions that last for 1 or 2 seconds, she wants people to hold them for 12 seconds. So imagine getting into a really painful position and holding it for 12 seconds over and over again. That is her version of the class that challenges her regulars.
Rachel, are there concerns perhaps that the trainers or the people running these classes may not be able to recognize issues that some of the people are having with the difficulty, or are they trained well enough?
Well, certainly that's always a concern. You know, you don't want to get into especially one of these higher level classes without already being quite fit. But, you know, there are sort of some checks and balances in place. And at the New York Studio I mentioned, they actually don't allow beginners into this class. You have to take at least 5 of their sort of regular classes before you're even considered. And even then, an instructor has to approve your admittance. He also has done some recruiting in their regular classes and, you know, singling out someone who is really fit and seems like he or she needs a new challenge. And so I think that the trainers generally are fairly mindful of people's ability level. And these are boutiques, so they tend to be smaller classes with a lot of instruction. Oftentimes they're led by personal trainers who have maybe more background in instruction and just training in these different modalities. So these are definitely more sort of labor-intensive than your garden variety, you know, large gym group fitness class.
We're speaking with Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal. Rachel, in doing research for your story on these kinds of gyms and boutiques, did you find people suffered any injuries or unusual injuries from taking these kinds of classes?
I didn't in this case. Now, certainly, that doesn't mean that people don't suffer injuries. I think the pitfalls are when people ramp up too quickly. You know, you have a New Year's resolution, you have them going to the gym, and suddenly you're trying to set your personal record or you know, lift a record amount of weight. That is the wrong way to go about it. You know, many of these people have been working out for their entire lives and, you know, already have quite a high base level. But, you know, for people who are just beginning, much better to do something that maybe leaves a little sore but does not leave you sprawled out on the floor, as one of the photos of my story shows.
Thanks, Jennifer. This weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us on this first full weekend in January. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, guidance on what to expense and not expense to your company. Also, why we love those tacos from Jack in the Box when they don't even market them. And the future of the rescue ship from The Perfect Storm. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, in 2017, we will see massive changes in transportation, government, cyber warfare, and other areas we aren't remotely ready for. Here's a look into the crystal ball about what's ahead from tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group, a tech advisory firm. Rob, what's ahead?
Well, talk about a lot of things surrounding technology and, of course, the Trump election, which is going to change an awful lot of things. Looking at technology, one of the big things, of course, are the huge drones. Both Amazon and a company out of China that's building drones that will carry people are in broad trials now. And as we got towards the end of the year, Amazon announced that they're going to have dirigibles, basically flying warehouses that these drones are going to be looping into. So they'll have huge dirigibles overhead, and they don't want to leave out Facebook. They're planning on having a fleet of 10,000 of the damn things flying overhead. 10,000 means they'll probably have the largest air force in the world. So let's hope they don't turn hostile.
Right.
But we're going to have a lot of one of the big things is we're going to have just a lot of drones overhead this year, both in test and in deployment.
Boy, oh boy! All right, so revisit what's happening in Asia here with this experiment involving drones carrying people. Are we talking about, say, you work at a large office complex and you might get lifted from one building to another? Or are we talking about you in the Pacific Northwest and me in New Jersey, like meeting to have lunch somewhere in Iowa because we can do this?
Well, remember these things are electric. So we're talking a limited range. And the test is actually going on in Nevada. So the company's in China, but the trial's in Nevada. So it's actually happening here in the U.S. These are short hop. So you figured that these would be used to get people, say, 10 to 15 miles max, pick you up outside your house, take you to your work, kind of like a flying Uber. You wouldn't own them.
Yeah.
They would pick you up and deliver you, much like Amazon's going to be delivering packages. Though if we start extending beyond this dirigible idea that Amazon has, there's certainly a possibility that somebody could use these things to carry you up to a dirigible that then moves a lot of people point to point. Say if a bunch of people are going from one location to another, say an airport, that might be a way to avoid traffic. And it would certainly eliminate a lot of the regional airports that currently exist, because this would be another way to solve that same problem without actually having to have an airport. So, but that wouldn't be this year. That would be like next decade. But the dirigible thing is pretty disruptive.
Yeah, we're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the tech advisory firm the Enderle Group. He's written a piece called "Looking Ahead to 2017: The Year Everything Changes." All right, so on a slightly more serious note here, what about this alleged Russian hacking? Where do we go with this?
Well, so we actually given that Obama was talking about a response earlier when I wrote this, I was thinking the Russians would respond in kind. They didn't. They didn't respond in kind. But since then, I've been looking at the overall Russian hack, and it seems very doubtful Russia actually made this hack. Because to conclude that Russia did it, you have to conclude that they're kind of idiots at hacking. One, because they were so obvious about it. And number two, because the timing wasn't good for Trump. It was good for Bernie Sanders, which takes us back to that poor DNC guy that got killed, who Wikipedia says supplied them with the information. And if you really think about this, it wasn't the hack that was the problem. It was the release of the information that was the problem. And so it doesn't really matter who took the information. It really matters who delivered it, because that's what really did the damage. And so in your mind, is it more likely a DNC staffer who saw that his candidate, Bernie Sanders, was being mistreated, released the information during the primaries, or that Russia released the information during the primaries long before it would help Trump, after doing a really poor job of concealing the fact they took it? It's really starting to stretch my sense of credibility at this point that Russia did this, which once again, if they didn't do it, then there's no reason to retaliate. We're just waiting for Trump to come into office and then prove that they didn't do it. And of course, the last thing is, why would the DNC want Russia to look like they did it? Well, because the election kind of sucked on their side, and they're blaming Russia, so nobody's blaming them.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal of the Enderle Group. It's 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. You may have been creative with expensing things to your company in the past, but it is a risky move, as you know, that can threaten your job. Travel and expense management firm Certify polled business travelers for some of the oddest expenses they or a colleague had tried to push through this past year, like a llama as a photo prop. Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, has some examples and guidance on what's legit and what's not. Kelly, where do we start?
Well, this was some data coming out from a site called Certify, which actually does travel and expense management. And they had polled a variety of business travelers for weird expenses that either they have submitted or that they've seen a colleague submit. And among them was, of course, the llama, which is why we chose to put that in the headline. Weirdly, that one actually was approved. $28,000 in bottle service in Las Vegas, personalized bobblehead dolls, all sorts of unusual expenses that people have tried to put through. So we were trying to look at this and say, well, what does this actually do? This can be pretty damaging for your career and your own finances.
Right. All right. So the llama in particular was able to be expensed because why?
Well, the expectation on that one was it was something that a photographer felt like they needed a llama for some kind of a photo shoot, and that was something that was approved. The people who were looking at that expense report did deem that a necessary and appropriate expense.
Wow.
Which is, of course, the big thing for a lot of consumers. If you're filing expenses, you want to make sure that if it's something that's a little bit weird, that the boss is aware, ideally that they've approved that in advance and have deemed that strange expense something that's worthwhile.
Mm. As you mentioned, bottle service too, which in some cities can get really expensive.
It certainly can. And, you know, that was an interesting one. As we were talking to career experts there, they were saying a lot of this, it depends on your field, too. Something like bottle service, client entertainment could be something that is expected in a lot of different fields, a lot of different industries, especially if you are in sales and you're trying to, you know, woo in a new client, that even something like that $28,000 tab could be acceptable if it results in a contract or some sort of a business deal that is worth much more than that.
Mm. We're speaking with Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com, also certified financial planner. She's got a story called "No, You Can't Expense That Llama" and other wacky claims. What types of things are not getting approved here from the expense folks?
Well, you know, when you're looking at something like, you know, where it's not approved, the big risk that people need to keep in mind is that they might be on the hook for that expense themselves.
Oh, yeah.
Something else that didn't get approved within this list was someone renting a bagpipe player to perform at a party. You know, so this is the sort of thing where you really do need to figure out in advance before you actually go through the motions of making that purchase, booking that vendor, that this is going to be something that might be okay.
Tires for personal car not getting approved.
Not getting approved. Personal expenses are one of those problem things that a lot of people try to sneak through. They'll put in something that's actually a personal expense, and the company says, no way, we're not covering that. And that's something in particular that can be really damaging for folks, is you want to make sure that you're not being seen as abusing the system in some fashion. That in itself, we hear, can be a fireable offense.
Mm.
And even if it's not, and the company does choose to keep you around, they're almost certainly going to be looking at your reports a little more closely and maybe not giving you as many opportunities to be spending the company's money, which could mean you're not going on the conferences that are important for you professionally. You know, maybe you're not in a position to be leading a project because they don't think you're going to be responsible with that money.
Thanks, Kelly. Kelly Grant, consumer reporter at CNBC.com. 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Jack in the Box is known to most of the country for its hamburgers and big-headed mascot, but for many of its devotees, the magic of the fast food chain lies in its interpretation of a taco. What is it that makes this particular taco so popular? Here's Wall Street Journal editor Russell Adams, who has experience with the Jack in the Box taco. Russell, explain your story.
I grew up in San Diego, where Jack in the Box is based, and there are Jack in the Boxes everywhere, including one right near where I went to high school. And so I grew up eating a lot of Jack in the Box, and it was always a source of fascination for me why these things were so good, even though everything about them was so gross.
All right, so your description of this taco would be what?
My description? Well, I kind of like the guy's description in the lead of the story. The guy I spoke to, Mike Primavera in Seattle, he referred to them as a wet envelope of cat food, which I think is a pretty appropriate description, even though it's not exactly flattering. It does sort of have that that consistency. I like that, and I don't think I can top it. You know, I doubt Jack in the Box likes that description, but the guy who coined it does love them and can't get enough of them, so there's wow. That.
Jeez. What do you put on it typically?
Well, it's a beef mixture that's wrapped in a tortilla, and then they freeze it and ship it to the stores, and they, when somebody orders it, they stick the whole thing in a deep fryer, take it out, and put lettuce, a slice of American cheese, and hot sauce on it.
Mm.
And serve it. So in a lot of places, it's still 2 for $0.99, although I think in some stores they've raised the price, but it stayed that price for a long time.
Wow. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal editor Russell Adams. This piece is called Americans Eat 554 Million Jack-in-the-Box Tacos a Year, and No One Knows Why. All right, so obviously, that's a big number, but is that a good number sales-wise? Like, how's Jack-in-the-Box doing?
Oh, I mean, it's a very good number sales-wise. I don't know how much money they make on the tacos because they are so cheap. And they don't break that out, but it is their best single selling item on the menu. So it is a huge draw. It's something that they don't market at all. It's not part of any of their advertising. And as an executive there I spoke to said, it's because of its cult following and the fact that they don't really need to advertise it, it's sort of a marketer's dream.
How about that? They don't even advertise it. 554 million sold in a year. Wall Street Journal editor Russell Adams. I would eat them for sure, but the closest one to me is like an hour away. There's three way up in northern New Jersey. Not trekking that far. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Federal environmental officials still have not cleared a famous Coast Guard cutter to be sunk off the New Jersey coast. Delaware officials had wanted to add the Tamaroa to an artificial reef that it shares with New Jersey before the end of 2016. You may know the Tamaroa because her crew rescued seven people from a nor'easter in 1991 that became known as the Perfect Storm. 40-foot waves, 70-mile-an-hour winds off the New England coast that day. The story eventually became a book 6 years later and, of course, a movie in the year 2000. The delay is because the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is still waiting for lab results to see if the storied ship is free from cancer-causing PCBs. The 73-year-old ship, which served in World War II as the USS Zuni, has been undergoing an extensive cleanup at a shipyard in Virginia. Ultimately, it will lie about 120 feet below the surface near the Navy destroyer USS Arthur W. Radford, which was sunk in 2011. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.